Welcome to RevOps Corner, where we talk about how B2B SaaS companies scale through revenue operations by interviewing amazing guests and sharing what we see in the trenches every day here at Union Square Consulting. Welcome to RevOps Live number 16, how to grow a career in RevOps. Obviously, we see we have some people here at different stages in their career. And we've got our VP of RevOps, our new VP of RevOps, Joel Arnold, joining us.
Hey, everybody.
Joel, thanks for prepping this meeting for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here. Excited. This is one of my favorite topics.
Yeah. And Joel is our VP of RevOps, and this is the third time as a VP. And if I remember correctly, you were a director before that, a bunch of other things before that. So there's a lot to talk through about the journey that you've taken to get here.
Yeah. It's been a long and bumpy road with some detours along the way, but we're going to talk about some informal survey results that we've had. I think my story is pretty common, actually, it turns out.
Awesome. I'm excited to dive into it. And then as always, we have Sarah Ra, our event producer. Sarah, thank you for helping us coordinate and put this together.
Hi, everyone. I'm excited for today's show. Thank you.
So anybody that's not familiar with us, we're a revenue operations consulting firm, and we do this event and produce this or record this to the podcast every single week. We also put out a newsletter every week. So if you're interested in checking that out, Sarah will put the link in the chat here. And the newsletter is very similar to our podcast. And if you don't have an hour to listen to it, you can get some really good nuggets of information on various best practices within RevOps by subscribing. On today's event, I'm going to start off with Joel walking through the results of an informal survey that he did of 20 other VPs of RevOps. So not just anyone in RevOps, but senior leadership. And then he's going to share his experience and how he's gone through his career path. And I'm going to pepper him with questions and also share my own perspective on what I've seen in my career, as well as what I've seen in hiring people and building our team and also interviewing folks that we didn't hire. So again, Sarah will share all these links in the chat. I'll give Joel a little bit of time to go through some things and I'll start peppering him with questions. And I welcome you guys in the audience to throw your questions in the chat as well. And we'll call on you pretty quickly. And then you can unmute your microphone and turn on your video and you can ask your question. Or if for some reason you're not comfortable with that, just put that in the chat and maybe Sarah can ask the question for you. But without further ado, I'll turn this over to you, Joel, to kind of share what you saw in this survey.
Sure. And thank you again for everybody for letting me have the opportunity to present to you today. I sitting in this position and going through this process a couple of times, being a VP of revenue operations for a B2B SaaS company, I have often gotten this sort of question, and I haven't really had a lot of time in the past to sort of dig into it and really put together any data around it. So I really enjoy the question. I really enjoy the topic. And when I was given the opportunity to sort of bring this to this week's session, I thought about a couple different ways to go about it. But the one that jumped out at me is just go look at people's LinkedIn and start tabulating some data to figure out where the heck everybody came from. It's pretty a small sample size, to be honest, 20 to 25 people. I added myself in that list. I tried to make it as random as possible. And I wanted to make sure that I captured all of the different jobs that everybody had on their way to becoming a VP of RevOps. Because I think that's, there's a lot of demand for that role nowadays. And it seems like the people that got there always, you hear stories of coming from all kinds of different directions. Hey, I was in marketing, or I was in sales ops, or I was in strategy or biz ops or something like that. And, we would just wanted to put some numbers around the anecdotes that we've been hearing. So again, my methodology here was pretty informal. I did not go through the people that I was simply connected with on LinkedIn. I just did a random search for VP of RevOps and then looked for B2B SaaS companies and tabulated all the different roles that they had filled in their career until the point with which they achieved the leadership and RevOps position. So that's more or less it. And I think our findings align to the anecdotal evidence largely, but may not be what we sort of expected going in to a degree. I think we'll get to the CS point here in a bit, but We saw a lot less CS than I was expecting to see or I was hoping to see. And I do think that as of right now, the market is undervaluing that as a part of the RevOps environment. And then the second thing that was a surprise to me was the technologists. And I'm classifying as technologist as largely someone who is in charge for administering and building, implementing the tech stack. So just as a tally of the 20 people plus myself that were included in this list, 17 of them, and this is the most common, so I'm kind of going to go through the list of most common things that we saw. 17 of them had held sales operations roles at some point in the past. That is by far the most common thing that we're seeing. And just so you know, these numbers are roles filled, not necessarily it was number of times that they had been in a role as opposed to just had they filled that role, yes or no. So for example, sales operations means if you had served as the head of sales operations twice on your way to becoming the VP of RevOps, you were marked down twice. So we had 17 roles filled by sales operations by the 20 people that we had in revenue operations. Our second most common thing that we were seeing is just a general operations role. I think this makes a lot of sense as well. I filed this one under business operations, but it's anything outside of the scope of sales, marketing, CS operations in the company, product operations, general operations, sourcing and things like that. I also classified here, although that was very rare. And those were by far the two largest. So we had 14 roles that were filled by, or 14 business operations roles that were filled by the people in this list. After that, there was a pretty decent sized decrease. So you had 17 and then 14. And then the next thing up was sales. So again, I don't think this is a surprise to me. I'm surprised it's third. I feel like a lot of people that I've spoken to and I know from the industry have gone into sales roles sort of early-ish in their career. And Eddie, you might be able to speak to this one as well. You know, starting off in that AE position and then getting really interested into either the technology or the back office operations component of this, and then making a career transition sort of early-ish in your career and growing on the operations side of the house thereafter. We saw that in 10 scenarios here amongst the 21 people that we looked at. Eddie, is there anything from your experience you'd like to add there?
Yeah, absolutely. I was trying to decide whether to hold back until you were done going through this, but since you called on me, I'll go for it. I think it would be interesting, right? Like obviously with a sample size of 20, this isn't exactly scientific research, but I do think it's big enough to get a broad swath and understand what you see in the market. And it aligns with what I've seen interviewing dozens, if not hundreds of people. And I would say from my own personal experience, it depends a lot on, let me back this up. To make the transition from sales into sales operations or revenue operations, you're much better established and set up if you're working in a really small startup where you don't have that already in place. Whereas when I worked at a company like Salesforce, I'm not doing any type of sales ops or rev ops. I can't touch Salesforce. I can't make a single update. I could barely run a report. Everything is handed to me on a silver platter. Whereas when I was AE number one at a B2B SaaS startup, we had no one doing that. And if I wanted to see updates in Salesforce, or at the time, like this was before Outreach was even launched, I had to build a version of Outreach from scratch with custom objects in Salesforce in order to run my outbound program. You know, you learn that kind of stuff sort of like trial by fire. And then if you like that kind of stuff, then I think it's a natural tendency to say, oh, wow, like this is really interesting. And maybe I'm not in love with, you know, the sales career and I want to go in this direction instead. But, you know, obviously there's so many people that work at large organizations like Salesforce. And so if we're looking just at like statistics, it would make sense that the majority of salespeople don't go down that path. Not to mention the fact that, you know, if you like sales, it's a pretty lucrative career that a lot of people want to stick with.
Yeah. And it's a totally different mindset. But I think a lot of the more successful folks, the ones that I think have knowledge or mind share, so to speak, in the RevOps space, had some period in their career, sometime carrying a bag and carrying a quota. And, you know, I really appreciate the people that have done both. I think they bring in a nice perspective to things. And, you know, when you think about being in revenue operations, oftentimes your customer is the salesperson at the end of the day. And so making sure that you have the perspective of what it's like to sit in that seat, I think is really powerful. So those are the top three. After that, I'm going to go a little bit faster here. Marketing. We saw a lot of marketing roles, almost as many as sales roles. It's not specifically a role, but the next thing on the list is we saw nine MBAs out of a cadre of 20 people. I think that may speak to like a high, well, I'll get into why I think that's important, but I think it speaks to sort of a cross-functional knowledge set that people in this role need to have. And I think an MBA might accelerate that. We had a few people from finance, eight of them, almost as many as marketing, same number of people that had strategy roles of some kind. We saw a lot of project managers and business development. So sort of, again, sitting in that, maybe sitting in that role where you've got a quota or you're doing outbound prospecting activities. So I think it's very clear to me that the quickest path to being a leader in revenue operations is operationally getting really sound. So sales operations and business operations are the top two things on that list, by far and away the largest quantity of people. And it sort of feels like as the profession has developed, it's largely grown out of sales operations. You know, we don't like necessarily as RevOps operators to think of ourselves as sales operations plus, but the reality is that a lot of people come from that background. And so they're naturally going to be a little bit stronger there. And maybe the perception is of those folks or others like them that really revenue operations is this outgrowth of sales operations to a degree. I've certainly felt that in my career.
Yeah. And I will say that, Joel, I see that a lot in the market. I mean, in trying to fill this role with you, we interviewed dozens and dozens of candidates. We probably looked at hundreds of resumes, and you start to see some commonalities. You see a really strong bias towards a sales background, to a lesser extent, marketing and marketing operations. And then, as we've mentioned, like we saw very little, maybe no real strong backgrounds in customer success, with the exception of people that were well-rounded. But I don't remember a single candidate that we looked at, even just at like a resume screening stage, where it was like, wow, this person dedicated themselves to customer success for an extended period of time.
Yeah, and I expect that to change personally. I mean, obviously I don't have data to back this up, but it sort of feels like in its nascent stage, revenue operations felt like an outgrowth of sales operations. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But over time, as revenue operations really started gaining momentum, I think the next logical step was for, you know, expertise in marketing to come along. It's reached a point now where if you don't have marketing expertise, you're just not doing revenue operations, or you shouldn't even have that title. But I do think that a lot of people that do or are leading revenue operations functions are still sort of distanced a little bit from CS operations. And I'm not exactly sure why. I think it's just a maturity of the market and maturity of the companies that are starting to take revenue operations on as a function.
I would make the case, and I can't back this up with hard data, but my sense is that it's a function of revenue operations taking off specifically in the world of B2B SaaS. You don't see this job title, this term nearly as frequently in any other industry, which is really funny. Somebody sent me a cold email talking about revenue operations in foreign exchange. And I was like, oh, wait, they have revenue operations too. It's totally different from what we're talking about here. But I've yet to see revenue operations well represented in any other industry in the sense that we do it. And with these early stage SaaS companies and all the capital that's been pouring into the industry the last many years, the focus has all been on logo acquisition. And I think that we're going to need to see a shift to, we need to be laser focused on net revenue retention. We need to be have a really tight process for renewals. We need to make sure that we're on top of making sure our customers are handed off to onboarding and implementations well. We need to measure customer health well. And then of course, like customer service is a whole beast in and of itself. If you think about call centers, but I think like most startups aren't going to have call centers. So that's less of an issue. And I know when I worked at Salesforce, a lot of the people that I worked with that had had deep experience in that realm really came from like the call center world, not from the startup world.
Sure. Sure. Well, it's actually interesting. You make that point that it, you know, revenue operations is a natural outgrowth potentially of the B2B SaaS world. And that's where it was really adopted early. It was developed there. What's interesting about that is a lot of different industries don't have the subscription model the way that a B2B SaaS company has. I mean, it's heavily reliant on the subscription component of the business and just the fact that the majority of your revenue is coming from recurring revenue sources. And the nature of how those contracts and all the different pieces link together differently in that world, it's still not quite in the, what we're seeing here is they're still not quite in a place where they're seeing the whole revenue cycle end to end underneath RevOps. And I think that's really interesting. And I think that that is going to change. I think it naturally has to. And you point to in your comments there, the business cycle that we're in, we're not growth at all costs right now. Right, but the cost of capital has gone up increasingly. The easiest way to have new revenue sources and selling new things is by retaining and growing the customers that you have. And so how do you link together your new sales cycle with the retention sales cycles in a way that makes sense to a lot of people? And the natural tendency is, well, one, we need a CS operations function, period, because you need someone to care and feed all of the technology and the process and the documentation. But then the natural tendency is to say, I think after that, or will be the natural tendency, is to have that roll up underneath the revenue function, which then will make it end to end. I think the development of revenue operations as a function happening in the world where money was cheap sort of led to the growth at all costs, led to sales operations being the source of it in the initial stages and marketing being the second thing that came along. And now the business cycle is flipped. And I think CS is going to come along. At least I hope it does, because it's linking all those things together is a huge boon for everybody. I would point to sort of the way that we think of demand gen or just generally the marketing process. There's no better group of people to market to than your own customers. And I think people lose sight of that. I think that people are always thinking about lead gen. Well, in a manner of speaking, lead gen from your current customers is the easiest lead gen you're going to have. It's the lowest cost to acquire a customer, in quotes here. So they're going to come together. It's just going to blend. And I don't have absolute data to back that up, but it just logically, I can't see it going any other way.
Yeah. And just speaking from my own personal experience, I think this is year 21 of me being in either a commission sales role or running a company where I live and die by our ability to generate revenue. And throughout most of that journey, I've been covering new logos and existing business. And I remember when I entered SaaS about halfway through that journey, about 12 years ago, as the first AE at a SaaS startup, one of my first questions to them was, why am I only calling new logos? What about our existing customer base? And I remember their reaction was just to kind of look at me like I was a little bit crazy. And I don't think that they were offended at the question, but it was just like, no, like we have people covering that. And by people, they meant like their, you know, customer service team, their, you know, we did our own in-house implementations. This was a product built on top of Salesforce. So we had some really smart people there, but I'm like, yeah, okay, that's great. But these are not salespeople. How are they thinking about getting a meeting with that new stakeholder that we've never talked to before, for example? And when I went to Salesforce, this was just part of the playbook. And it was really obvious. It's like, okay, you can go and cold call new logos all day long. That's really, really difficult. If you haven't exhausted your existing customers, if you have a relationship with the VP of sales, I think everybody understands like what Salesforce does and how they sell. VP of sales is typically the main point of contact. Okay, now let's move over to like the, let's sell service cloud. Let's move over to the head of customer service, or oftentimes it's the COO that was making the decisions when I was there. Are we talking to the CFO? Are we talking to the CMO? Are we talking to the CEO? Because I was covering like high growth startups, not enterprise customers. And there's just so much like low hanging fruit there that, you know, why would you neglect that to go call somebody that like has never, not that anybody's never heard of Salesforce, but, you know, breaking into a new company is an incredible, incredible effort.
It's huge. It's a huge mountain to climb, especially as budgets are tight these days. So, you know, it behooves you to go into your current customers. And there was one comment that was made, white space, exclamation point. That's absolutely right. Yes. And for some pointers on how to dive in and identify that white space, take a look at the pyramid newsletter that we recently released. I think it's got a couple of good points in there on how to kind of develop or identify where that white space is and kind of quantify it. But anyway, going back to this, I think it's just what the future is going to be. I don't think the market is going to allow it to be anything different. We need to get better, and we need to include CS operations in revenue operations in order to make an organization the most efficient it can be.
Joel, I wanted to plug your newsletter a little bit more. So we're releasing that on Friday. Thank you for writing it, by the way.
No.
And so,
well, that was our last podcast, by the way. Sorry about
yeah.
that.
Yeah. So we did the last podcast on this pyramid, and you talking about your structure for thinking about how a company matures from the beginning of not even having a CRM to building a really sophisticated revenue operation. And I think it's also a really great rubric for people to think about how to grow in their careers as well. And it matches really well what I think we've seen with a lot of our early stage, like we just raised our Series A startups, where you start off with, you know, hey, we're going to go hire a sales team. So we need to implement Salesforce, and we need to build out our sales methodology and process. Once you have that in place, you start thinking about marketing and implementing HubSpot or Marketo or Pardot. And then CS does seem to come third. And this newsletter is going to be published on Friday. So check out the website if you want to see it. It's a really concise 3-minute read to cover what we spent an hour talking about last week. And it makes sense that, like, I'm thinking of one of our customers in particular that fits this to a T. And their customer success is their COO, who's doing everything herself by herself. And on one hand, we do want to build the infrastructure for the future. On the other hand, you know, they're just trying to grab these new logos and then they're handing them over to a very senior and experienced person. It's not like she's letting things slip through the cracks, but obviously that's not scalable. So we do need to tackle that, but it's been difficult for us to justify doing that as the very first priority.
Yeah, I think it makes sense as well, because if you're thinking about something that's young and growing, you probably don't have that many customers to care and feed. So mm-hmm. CS can be a little bit of a slower roll, I think, than the new sales thing, but it should be a fast follow. But that's going to depend upon your maturity as a company, what your install base is, what your product is, et cetera. I don't think just because it happens after something that it's less important. I actually think it's probably the most important function within the revenue stack, but personal opinions on that one.
I don't disagree with you. Anyway, where do we go from here? I've got more questions and comments on what you were covering, but did you want to dive into something else?
Yeah, I just want to call out a couple of things before we get tactical about, like, what are some things that you can do or focus on to kind of grow your career. The first thing that we sort of previewed earlier, but we didn't really get into in a deep way, was other than the CS thing, was the other thing that we saw missing, which was actually quite a surprise to me. I think, there's not anyone who was a Salesforce admin on this list.
I don't find that surprising at all.
Well, you would think so, because at least for me, when I get asked this question, it's often people that are in a technology leadership role within the revenue organization that are asking, like, how do I get a seat at the table? How do I get into higher level conversations? I'm the head of whatever that role is, in charge of the tech stack. It's from Salesforce admin, senior Salesforce admin, revenue technologist, et cetera, et cetera. There's all kinds of different names for it. But I think a lot of people there feel like they've got a lot of value to add and want to grow, I guess, upward, so to speak, in that. It does not appear to be a great path, or at least has not historically, from what I can tell, turned into a great path to becoming a RevOps leader. And I think so. And this was a decision that I made early on in my career. It's I personally kind of identified that, and I purposely did not get certified in any Salesforce administration, coding, any sort of trailhead kind of a thing, because I was worried about being seen as a technology guy, and I have pushed back against that. I think what we're seeing here is there are multiple paths to have a great career in revenue operations. But if you want to be sort of seen as a sort of strategic thinker, being a technologist could be a hindrance to that. I don't like that, but it does appear to be the case.
It is really interesting you say that. So I'm not only a Salesforce admin, I have multiple certifications, three of them. I could have gone further, but I agree with every sentiment you just shared. I can't remember if I even have this listed on my LinkedIn. I've never had a job title that was anything remotely like Salesforce admin. It's not something I advertise for the exact reasons that you share. And I think the challenge is if you're 22 years old and you come out of school and you get that Salesforce admin cert and job title, you have a fork in the road that you need to decide to go down. And many folks decide to go down that technical fork and they become eventually a solution architect or a technical architect or this, that, or the other. And I've hired many of these people. I'm friends with even more of them. And they inevitably end up doing these $1 million implementations for Fortune 500 companies. And that's a great career path. But when you're sitting down with a bunch of stakeholders that are six layers removed from the executive team, building out like architecture in Salesforce for how, and we've done projects like this too. We don't do them anymore. I mean, we built out the architecture in Salesforce for the largest owner of apartment complexes in the country to renovate 45,000 apartment complexes each year. That didn't teach us anything about RevOps. You know, it doesn't teach us anything about driving revenue. It teaches us about architecture and workflows and APIs and data governance and things like this, which there's some validity there, but you're so deep in the weeds that you're not learning like, okay, how do we help salespeople sell more? How do we help marketing generate more meetings with people that want to talk to our sales team? How does CS renew and grow accounts? And I think that if you are that Salesforce admin, that's, you know, whatever age you are, and you want to take that next step, then you simply need to start investing time to understand those things, which Joel, I know you're going to start sharing how you've done that yourself.
Sure. And I think this is a good transition to sort of the tactical component of the conversation. I mean, obviously we can call out, you know, jobs that lead to RevOps leadership or jobs that don't, but I think it's less about the jobs and more about the mindset and the willingness to take on different things. So if you want to be the head of revenue operations, there's a lot of opportunity there. It is a great career. I absolutely love it. I'm never bored a moment. I think one of the best things that you can do is build a skill set that is broader than it is deep to begin with. There are a lot of things that you can do that. So another thing that we saw within this list is that people jumped around a lot earlier in their career. So they were a financial analyst, and then they did some operations, and then maybe did some strategy, and then they maybe got an MBA. You know, like they did all kinds of different things. They gave them an end-to-end view of business generally that I think serves you really, really well when it gets to being the leader of a team that's in charge of revenue operations for a company. Just personally, from my own experience, I started off in implementing software. I was kind of a technologist early on in my career, although I wasn't like an engineer or anything, but I was installing software at healthcare organizations as a consultant. I did that for 3 years. And then I went and worked for a startup briefly. Then I went and I got a business degree because, an MBA I felt like would give me the financial skills that I didn't quite acquire, I didn't think, to a deep enough level early in my career. And then I went into a rotational program after my MBA at a Fortune 250. I was crazy. I was bouncing around all over the place because my interests lie everywhere and I wanted to learn a little bit about everything. I think that wanting to learn a little bit about everything and trying a bunch of stuff is frankly the greatest platform to grow from. And I think we see it in the profiles that I looked at. People did a ton of different kinds of things early in their career.
Joel, I want to stop you there. Can you share what a rotational program is for anybody not familiar with it? And from a particular angle of like, why is it that people that get their MBA or go to like undergrad business school are so excited about these rotational programs?
Sure. So a rotational program is something that new hires out of a university, usually, it could be a boot camp as well, but most commonly a university degree, go through at usually a pretty large company. So for me, it was, I worked for Discover Financial, you know, the big credit card company, but they own a large number of other companies, mortgage companies and student loan companies and et cetera, under their umbrella. I went into, my offer was to go into an organization and spend 6 months to a year in a different department for a couple of years. So I was in, I did some strategy work, I did procurement work, I did operations, I would spend a little bit of time in FP&A. And then eventually, as I was sort of graduating out of that, I went into product leadership. So it was in the mobile applications. I was a product owner on a Scrum team. I got to see all different parts of a business at a pretty high level. And I think that really sort of rapid exposure to a lot of different things is what rotational programs offer and why I think they're quite in demand.
Yeah, I mean, my perception is also that a lot of these rotational programs are targeting people that have very good grades or very good degrees and are seen as high potential. And it's a, what's the word here? It's a program to basically, man, I can't think of the right word, but to find future executives.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. But if that's open to you, if you're a college student or you're thinking about going and getting your MBA, it is a huge thing to take a look at. But I mean, I know a lot of the people that are going to be listening to this aren't college students, you know, aren't in business school at the moment. And so what kind of things can they do, I think, is that make your own rotational program to a degree. Like, it's if you want to be, you know, a vice president at a SaaS company, it's going to take some time to get there. So as you're kind of progressing throughout your career, always be on the lookout for that adjacent thing that you can jump to as your next 2 year stint, et cetera. That's going to give you a little bit more of a functional understanding of what are the operations of CS look like? What are the operations in the marketing team? How do you run an implementation appropriately? How do you service customers for your particular product? There's a lot of different things that would lead you to have a good understanding end to end of the customer journey that you can create for yourself. And I'm sure if you speak to your leadership in most places, they will be willing to at least entertain the idea of, you know, that job opened up in CS. I'd like to give that a shot. What do I need to do in order to be, you know, placed in that position?
Well, the reason I bring up like why people do this is exactly what you just described. I think based on conversations with a lot of my friends that have done this, they get into these rotational programs. And the idea is you may one day become an executive of this Fortune 500 company. We want you to understand, even well before you get there, you go into middle management, how do all the different units of the business operate? You may go into a particular division thinking like, this is not my calling in life, but I'm going to spend a little bit of time here so I understand how it works and go on to the next thing. And I think if you replicate that in a startup, that can be really valuable experience where you now get to that VP level and you've seen every area of the business and you understand how sales and marketing work together, how CS comes into play, how this relates to finance, how this relates to product, et cetera, et cetera. And you have a higher overview as opposed to somebody who has only seen one angle of it.
Absolutely. You know, that is the superpower of revenue operations leaders. It's the ability to see all the different pieces of the puzzle and how they fit together. I can't tell you how many times I've sat down one-on-one with a C-suite executive and kind of walk them through, okay, well, if you decide to do this thing, here are all the outputs that are going to happen. Here are all the things that are going to get triggered. And here are the implications of all those different things. Are you sure you want to do this? Or should we tweak it slightly so that this thing instead happens? When you're looking across marketing and sales and implementation and customer success and finance and all these different things, you need to be able to speak the language. And I think being able to understand what about, like how to be able to read a balance sheet, how to understand how, if I spend more on driving traffic to the website via paid search, what is that going to do to the overall model of your expense ratios across the entire revenue team? And so it doesn't blow out your CAC. What is, if we tweak this and we improve retention by 5%, what is the outcome going to be on the valuation of the company in the current market? Like there are so many different pieces of this that you need to be able to stitch together to, obviously no one's going to be an expert in everything, but at least to a reasonable degree And I think, you know, if you're not going to go get a degree in general, like a master's in business, which is totally a great thing to do to help accelerate this, but if you're not going to do that, then going in and working and spending some time in a couple of different functional areas is really the path forward, I think, for most people.
Yeah. And I'll share an example from my experience here. I spent the first 10 years of my career in finance, albeit in a sales role. I got a lot of exposure to finance. When I joined Salesforce and I was working with my fellow account executives, I noticed a couple of things that were really difficult for them in having sort of CFO level conversations. Number one, a lot of them didn't understand the concept that like a CFO is not going to invest $1 into something that's risky with the potential to get a return of $1. They're like, oh, you got your ROI here. It's like, no, this is a really risky endeavor and they have other things on their plate and they have to look through this from an investment perspective of how do I deploy capital? What is the risk and where do I place my bets? And having that background, understanding how companies make financial decisions was incredibly powerful for me. Not to mention just the Excel skills of being able to sit down in front of a CFO and say, here are a few options for things you're thinking about doing, and here's how this plays out financially. So I'd have my colleagues constantly coming over to me saying, hey, can you help me build this Excel model? I have this presentation to the CFO tomorrow. And so, yeah, like I noticed somebody is making a comment about coming from finance. Like I see a lot of people coming from finance, and I think that's why they understand how revenue translates over and impacts finance.
Yeah. I mean, if you're in a B2B SaaS company, you need, and you have aspirations to be in revenue operations, you need to go understand ASC 606 yesterday. And for those that aren't aware, it's simply a change to the accounting standards that came through a couple of different years ago and has to do with how you recognize revenue on subscription or long-term contracts. And it is a change from what was happening before. So you need to understand that. It's the same sort of thing where you need to be able to understand what is GDPR. So that you make sure that you and CCPA, and so they make sure you stay compliant on the marketing side of the house around basically privacy and protection laws around that. So there's a lot of different things. And this is why I love RevOps. It's because you get to touch on all these different components and you're always learning something new. There's always some sort of change that you have to stay on top of. And so, I mean, my brain is firing all the time. I'm learning so much constantly and that's why I love it. So I commend anybody who's looking to go and be a RevOps leader. The homework or the tough or the school of hard knocks that you have to go through though is you do have to learn a fair amount about a lot of different topics. But that's the fun of it too at the same time.
Let's talk about some tactical tips to do this short of going and getting another job or role. The comment that was made in the chat, I couldn't read it while talking, was, hey, like, go sit down with your controller for an hour and ask them to explain how they make these financial decisions. I think that that's a great tip. What else can you share that you've done in your career, Joel, just to start learning in lieu of taking a whole, you know, dedicated role?
Sure. There are so many resources available simply just online. The world of podcasts, for example, has exploded. There's a lot of great podcasts out there. I mean, just go subscribe to Saster and just listen to it, like just burn through it, like binge on some Saster. That's a really, really great one. And they cover all kinds of different topics about B2B SaaS businesses. I would say spend some time getting your Excel skills up to a pretty high degree. I can recommend a former professor of mine who does basically online courses in Excel. His name is Wayne Winston. He's got a bunch of online courses. They're not terribly expensive. And the dude is a whiz. I mean, we'll put it this way. When Microsoft has questions about Excel, a lot of the people that created Excel or wrote the code back in the day are now retired and have been for a while. So who do they go to? They go to Wayne when they want to know more about Excel. Like he's the man. I can go down that for a while, but he's got a bunch of Excel websites. He's got an Excel website with a bunch of courses online. Go find the thought leaders in the space. It is a really publicly discussed thing. I mean, not just Eddie and myself, but there are a ton of really great resources out there that are thinking about and talking about revenue operations and how it's developing. And, you know, there's no harm in trying to be one of those either. So I think there's a lot of room in this space. I think there's a lot of learning that's still going on. I don't think it's a finished product. So every single one of the people that's on the call today has the opportunity to sort of mold the future of revenue operations as well as just learning it and picking it up.
Yeah, I'll add some things to that. So in terms of podcasts, I'm a huge fan of everything Refine Labs puts out. Their new podcast is Revenue Vitals. They actually have a few of them. And it's really great, not only for learning marketing, but also marketing operations. I mean, the amount of time they spend talking about Salesforce and how marketing impacts the actual sales funnel and not just marketing tactics is something I've been binge consuming for the last 2 years. Also, Dave Gerhart's podcast. Reading books is obviously really helpful. Spending a lot of time on LinkedIn, like there's a lot of people talking about every aspect of revenue operations. That can be really helpful. But then there's also just doing things, right? Like, as you say, like, okay, like I don't know how to do marketing attribution. Like, okay, so go do it. Go find your data. Go Google how to do it. Watch some YouTube videos on it. Try it out. See if it works. Listen to some podcasts on marketing attribution and the best practices. And this is one thing that I see such a deficit in, just in general, in people's careers. People will spend 20 years working on something without reading like the top three books on that thing. Like you'll see people that will hire 100 people and never read like the top three books on how to like hire great people. This is something I've done. Doesn't make me the world's best like recruiter or manager, but I can't imagine just trying to figure it all out myself from scratch. Like there's people that have literally written the playbook for it. Go read the book cover to cover, write down the things from it, go put it into practice. So I'll go read these like three books on recruiting, for example, because that's not something I had a lot of experience in before founding a company. And then I'm like, okay, it tells me to do these five things. Let me go physically write that down in a document, build that out, and then go put it in practice, and then keep going back to the book as a reference material. And I think that that is a superpower that unfortunately a lot of people don't take advantage of.
Yeah, it's a little bit of extra effort, but it pays off hugely in the end. I mean, so I spent, after I left Discover, I was hired to go work for a private equity firm. And I was put into another sort of rotational program, but it was more of like an executive leadership training thing. And more or less, it was another MBA, but it was an MBA in how to run SaaS companies, which has obviously paid dividends tremendously for me. Most of what we did in that course was read. We did a lot of reading. I mean, I burned out so many audiobooks. I can't tell you, but a couple of them that stand out that I could recommend to the people on the phone, Drive by David Pink, or Sir Daniel Pink, sorry, is phenomenal. It gets into the psychology of motivation in a way that I hadn't encountered before. And it actually might point in the direction of why you shouldn't have commission sales comp plans. But anyway, despite that, I think it's still a really, really good book. And I think he does perhaps have a point in the way he structured that. So that one's a really, really, really great book. The Checklist Manifesto. You could probably read the first 20 pages of that and get the whole gist. But basically, if you don't have a checklist, you don't have a process. And that checklists are the ways that places like the military and pilots and doctors and a lot of people that have to function at a very, very high level without ever making mistakes, that's how they do it. It's not revolutionary, but it does kind of prove the point. And I've number of checklists that I've built into systems and processes from that day forward is really, well, too many to count. And then, I mean, there are so many other books. It's a little bit old school at this point, but there's a book called Predictive Revenue. It's actually...
you mean Predictable Revenue?
Predictable Revenue. Yeah, sorry about that. That was written by some former executives, I believe at Salesforce, actually, that kind of lays out at least what the revenue operations model was maybe 10 years ago. But I think it sets a foundation really, really well to show how all these different pieces link together. So those are some book recommendations I would have. The last piece, as far as just tactical things you could do that I would recommend, is make sure that the people around you and above you know that you're interested in this and offer yourself to take on a project, maybe a little bit outside of your comfort zone, but something that would add value to the organization that you could do that would help you learn, but also, you know, give an aha moment to the people around you that say, hey, so-and-so, they did this really great thing. We should give them more things like that. That's always going to end well. And you're going to learn a lot in the process.
Yeah. I want to dive into executive engagement. So this is one of the reasons why I think we're not seeing a lot of Salesforce admins out there. I'll give you an example. I've interviewed literally hundreds of them, even very senior folks, and asked questions like, can you explain to me why you built that thing and what impact it had on revenue? And oftentimes, the majority of times, not hearing a very good answer for that. And it made me realize that like there is a skill to this. There are things to be learned in order to do this. How have you learned to do this? You got an MBA, you worked for a private equity firm, you were in a rotational program, but what are the specific things you learned on that path that helped you sit down in front of an executive and explain to them the why and the so what?
First off, I think most of it's communication or communication skills. I don't necessarily think that people that are early in their career or technologists or don't have a lot of experience don't fundamentally understand what they're working on. You know, they may not have sat down with a C-suite person before and said, you know, here's the experiment we're going to run. Here's the revenue that came out of it. You know, please invest in this thing. I think what executives are going to want is somebody that can translate the language that you're speaking on the technology or what have you side of things into what is the impact of the business generally. And it may not be revenue, it may be cost effect or efficiency, or it may be a reorganization thing that allows more lead generation. And maybe you can't tie that to cost, but maybe, you know, lead generation is a good thing. So let's do more of that. It's that connection piece. It's really that connection piece. And if you can get the business impact component of the story organized and together, and then have the data and the systems and the tools, which you're an expert in, and kind of come to the table with to back that up, I think that's when you start getting that conversation going, and people will then look to you as a subject matter expert. And so that's what gets the ball rolling, because once you're trusted, then you're in. And it doesn't matter if it's the person working in the cafeteria or the CEO, if you've got something of value to share, and they trust what you're bringing, then you're golden.
Yeah. And I think that there's a one really great way to do this is to just try to run a report in Salesforce or what have you, then to look at that information and take a step back from it and say, like, so what? I'm presenting this to the CEO, for example, and I'm going to say, hey, like, our close rate is X. So what? Okay. Like, well, if our close rate is X, then that means A, B, and C, right? First of all, let's put it in context. Is it lower or is it higher than it was yesterday? What's the trend happening? What happens when we dig a layer deeper? What does the close rate look like across different account reps? What does it look like across different products or territories? Like, how do we slice and dice this? How do I bring a narrative, a story to an executive to say, hey, this is what's happening in the business and this is why you should give a shit. Like, you've got a million things to be thinking about. This is why you should care about this. And I don't think there's a silver bullet that somebody that's never done this before is just going to, you know, hit the ball out of the park on the first try. I know that for me, you know, between working in operations and also working in sales, where I was approaching executives all day, every day at Salesforce and throwing ideas at them and just getting just absolutely shot down. But you learn from that experience too. And I think it's the making the effort and trying to say, hey, boss, like, I wanted to go a step further here and try to bring some insight to you. I think most good bosses are going to appreciate that and probably provide feedback and say, hey, you might want to look at it this way next time.
Yeah, I'd start with your boss, I think is a really good piece of advice there. You know, if you're, say it's, you roll up to a VP and you're trying to get a seat at the table or a conversation maybe with people, that person's boss. If you are bringing something to the table and getting feedback on it, and you're working on it, let's say it's a regular weekly report or something, and you've got some findings, and the person above you loves what you're bringing to the table, it's perfectly fine to ask them if they're showing it to their boss. And if not, maybe asking why as well. So I've used that for several of my reports. And actually, I built some dashboards once back in the day in Tableau that I really loved and was really proud of, but eventually my boss, who is the head of sales, loved them and shared them with his boss. So the CEO was looking at them every morning. And then the CEO said, hey, check out this stuff, because he was getting pinged by the investors about, hey, what's this metric? How is this trending, et cetera? And so that dashboard actually got shared with credentials to the equity firm that was owning the company. And so they were able to log in every time they had a question. And so it sort of led to this chain of events where whatever I was putting out there was going immediately to the owners of the company, which is crazy. But obviously that had huge cachet when it came to, you know, when I called out, you know, maybe this isn't working anymore, or this is, and this is something that anybody can do. I mean, a lot of what I do is just simple analysis in Excel. So if your Excel skills are reasonable level, you can export something out of Salesforce, or if you have a tool like a Tableau or a Power BI or something maybe more revenue specific, and there are a host of different tools out there, just monitoring and calling out and being consistent with it is a great way to sort of build up the perception within the organization that, one, you know what you're talking about, but two, that you're able to deliver regularly at a high level. And then three, you know, if I have a question about that thing, I'm going to go talk to so-and-so. And you want to be known as that expert.
Yeah. I mean, this reminds me of a story. I have a good friend, and I don't know if she was 22 at the time, but I think so. She started this marketing agency, and this is quite a long time ago. And at this point, like, digital marketing was cropping up. And so she latched onto this new trend of digital marketing and really did all the homework, all the things we're talking about, became the in-house expert of that. And so then the much more senior people in the organization started going to her, and she just kept rising and rising and rising. And she now is the CEO and the owner of the company. You know, I don't know if it's 20 years later or maybe more, but that's really how she built her career. Is in her 20s, she was able to latch onto this sort of newer trend that no one else understood and go really deep into it, something that she knew was taking off. And I'll give an example right now. Everybody's talking about ChatGPT. If somebody that was reporting to me came and said, look, here's a tangible way we could use ChatGPT to help our business, I would definitely listen to that.
Yeah, and to a lesser extent, but ChatGPT is awesome. It blows my mind. I can think of a million use cases about how to use that in revenue operations, to be honest. And I think everybody else who's used it can think about how to use it in their line of work as well. I think we are lucky because it seems a little bit strange, but I sort of feel like revenue operations has still got that aspect to it. Like proper Absolutely revenue right. operations is, you know, if you talk to some people, it's like, oh yeah, RevOps, that's been around forever or whatever. But most people, it's not. And even in most SaaS companies, it's not a thing yet. It's wild how that's still the case, but it is true, but it's going to be. And so you're in relatively early days still on something. We're early adopters of something that's going to be de rigueur everywhere. So kudos to you, but there's still a lot that hasn't been figured out yet. And there's a lot of technology, tools, best practices, et cetera, that are still being developed or changing as the market changes, that you can become an expert in. So absolutely find that thing that drives you or makes you excited and do your homework there. And you have a great potential future. The other thing about this is, you know, you mentioned there that she really did her homework and like doubled down and became an absolute expert in this thing that was growing. So let's think about this in terms of growing a RevOps career. Realize that you have to do the homework. You still have to do the work. And so, for example, we were just talking about, I ran an analysis and saw this was a trend and you should pay attention to this, Mr. Executive, because of X, Y, and Z. You can't do that if you don't have the ability and knowledge about how to run an analysis on something, which means that you may need to get your Excel or Google spreadsheet or whatever tool you use skills leveled up. You may need that. I don't know. Maybe you're a marketing operations person and you really know Marketo and or Pardot, demand gen, you know, the funnel metrics forward and backwards, but maybe you don't know Salesforce. And so maybe you need Salesforce in order to run the report to get you what you need to do the analysis, et cetera. You still have to do, I think I'm laying it down a little thick here, but you do have to do and do have to spend time learning all of the fundamental aspects of this. It's not quite a pyramid maybe like my other stuff here, but you do have to do the homework. You do have to do the legwork in order to earn that seat at the table. It's not going to be given.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think this is what really differentiates folks, because a lot of people, unfortunately, they want to say like, okay, who's going to train me? Who's going to show me the process? And with revenue operations, it's so new. I mean, so many people are in the role and they have nobody to look to. They may have a boss that has zero experience in revenue operations. And so you've got to go find these external resources. One thing we skipped over is all these communities, going to Pavilion, the RevOps Co-op, et cetera. You can hop into Slack and ask somebody a question. Hey, like I'm trying to do marketing attribution for the first time. Can somebody walk me through it? There's so much content being put out by vendors out there. We talked about insights. I get approached every single day by a new vendor that's saying, hey, we've got a plug into Salesforce and we do all of these revenue insights. And then you go to their website and they're publishing a blog post like multiple times a week talking about how to do X, Y, or Z. There's so much stuff on YouTube. I mean, TikTok now, I love TikTok because So you can say, oh, how do I do XYZ in Excel and search it in TikTok? And you might find a video that is 60 seconds long showing you how to do it.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, we are both growing up and spending time in our careers in an age where revenue operations is a burgeoning thing that hasn't been completely, absolutely locked down yet. And we are also coming through with social media and content marketing. And so there's a lot of stuff being published and a lot of knowledge being shared out there. And so if you want it, there are resources out there for you.
And you can go to ChatGPT and you can literally just say like, how do I do marketing attribution? Like it may not give you the best answer, but it at least gets you started. It's really amazing.
And make sure you ask it to do it in the style of Ernest Hemingway to keep it brief. You know.
Exactly. Let's see, where do we go from here? Also, I want to encourage the audience, like if you guys have questions, please feel free. No harm if you don't. But you know, this event is here for you guys. But in lieu of that, I want to talk about presentation skills. So we talked a little bit about the so what, but how do you translate that into the way that you actually present to somebody?
I think the biggest thing about presentation skills is learning to adjust to the audience. So even before you're getting into actually what you're showing, you need to be able to do that. Just know right off the top that an executive, getting the seat at the table, an executive is not going to sit through an hour-long 45-slide presentation. They don't have time for it. They're very, very busy people, and time is money. And so the best way is to be able to synthesize your findings. You know, here's what we looked at. Here's what our result was. That should be your first thing and why you should care. The second thing is, here's what we did to get that thing. And then maybe a little bit more after that. But with an executive, one pagers, summaries, one slide, get to the point. I forget what tool it was, but a lot of executives have this sort of mentality of be brief, be bright, and then be gone. That I've tried to stick to. I kind of work the same way, but it really, really, really does help. And a lot of people that are on action mode all the time, like most executives, who spend a lot of their time putting out fires, they don't have a lot of time to sit down on something, and they will ask you if they need more context or more analysis to back up your point.
Yeah, I was gonna touch on that, right? So, I mean, having gone to undergrad business school, just like you did, we went to the same school, ironically, not that we knew each other, but you know, it was drilled into us at Indiana that, you know, you've got to have the executive summary. You've got to summarize what you're presenting concisely on one page. Not everybody's had that exposure. And then if they want more information, they'll ask for it. And that's something I've seen working with you since you joined the team. Like, you're very concise. You're very good about just getting right to the point. And like, if you want more, we can spend more time on it.
Yeah, I certainly can ramble. You get me going and I won't shut up. So you're probably picking up on a little of that now, which is maybe good for a podcast format, but whatever. When I get to writing, I took this really great class. I believe the title of it was Writing to Get Things Done. But as the name implies, it was how do you get people to take action on the things that you send? Because most people maybe not are all the way up on their inbox. And executives certainly aren't. So a good rule of thumb that I caught out of that class was, you know, make sure your subject line has some content into it. You know, it's not just like this week's report. That's not helpful. You know, it's almost like writing a prospecting email. You want to have some sort of hook to make sure that people actually spend some time looking at the email. The second thing that you want to do is at the very beginning of your written communications is state exactly what action needs to happen or what the finding was. Like, what is the so what? And then underneath that, it's the steps that we went to find this thing or maybe some other things in bullet point format that someone should pay attention to or know about the background of this particular topic. And then, you know, maybe more content below that. But if you can give somebody a summary of the so what, the why, and, you know, here are the steps we got to get that piece of information right at the beginning, they don't need to read the rest, and they will read the rest if they need to. It's sort of like, here's the summary, and then too long didn't read section below that. And you can be as verbose as you want after that point.
Just love that framework. Okay, I want to take this back a little bit. Something we haven't touched on is just sort of like the actual career path itself. And you think about folks coming into a sales operations role or an early stage RevOps role, analyst, manager, et cetera, and then evolving to a director and then a VP. Mm-hmm. If we put those into three different buckets, let's just call it junior and then director and then VP. In your experience, how do you differentiate those three? And what do you think are the major things that you need to accomplish to go from one to the other?
I think it's specialization to generalization, I would say. That's the sort of name of the game there. Early on, or in a sort of a junior level, let's say maybe you're an analyst, maybe you are that Salesforce admin with aspirations to go down the operations route, or something adjacent to that. Let's say you're on that team. You are learning your craft in your specific area really, really well. And that's going to be great for you as you progress. Again, I would suggest maybe rotating independently in that world and getting some experience in a couple of different roles, but really it's all about learning and then learning to deliver, in the cadence that the business has. So if we think about, some businesses have an enterprise sale, it's a year-long sales cycle. What are the steps that you're experiencing living in that world where things are a little bit slower, where the deal size is a little bit larger, maybe they have more consensus buying processes where you have a lot of people at the table that all have to agree? What are you catching in the conversations that the sales and marketing people around you have? You could be on the marketing team, maybe you're doing demand generation. What tools are you using? How are we going to market? What are our personas? What, like learning the business generally is, and being like an expert at a specific sub function in that is really what the junior roles are about. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And so how do you move from that to director in your experience?
Well, I didn't have any experience being more junior than that and moving to a director. So I actually came through just sort of a general strategy and operations role at a director level and moved horizontally into what was then sales operations, but became sales and marketing and then revenue operations. But if I may, what I've seen with other folks there is that if you are doing a really, really good job and you have a pretty solid understanding of what the people around you are doing, and you show some grit and organizational skills, and you feel like you're ready, then, you know, start looking for management positions. And that may be a director, depends on where you're at. You know, a small enough company, the next step above direct frontline people is a director level. Does that answer your question? I know it's a little bit tap danced around it, but just personally, I don't have as much experience there.
I think it's a tough question because from what I've seen, like a director at one organization is very different from a director at the other.
Yeah.
And I don't have a consensus for how we define like, okay, in order to be a director of RevOps, you have to have XYZ. Because I think that that person might have a director title at one company, a VP title at another company, and yeah, something different at a third company. And I was simply kind of curious if you had seen any more consensus than I have.
I don't think there's particular consensus. I think what you're looking for, the biggest step is not the director to the VP. The biggest step is from frontline or manager to director. And in places that have managers below or team leads or supervisors or whatever you want to call them, sort of below the director and above the frontline folks. I think that's the right way to do it if you have a company large enough, is basically just learning bigger parts of the business, broader parts of the business, and developing that not just the experience, but also the ability to communicate well, the ability to be seen as a subject matter expert across multiple functions, the ability to be, having those executive level conversations and communicating clearly. Like, it's just all those business skills that kind of get you to the place where you might be eligible or might feel comfortable jumping to a director level role. And when you're in a director level role, you own the whole thing, right? You own all of revenue operations at that point. Usually there's not often a director or senior director rolling up to a revenue operations VP. You generally have either a VP or a director in my experience.
That's interesting. I think that might be the curveball, because one of the people that we interviewed for this role was a VP with a director reporting to them. Fairly large organization though.
Sorry to interrupt, but that's the bit in the sort of area that I've worked in and have more experience in. The companies are not large enough to have VP of revenue operations with directors of revenue operations underneath them. However, I know in large organizations, you just can't have that many frontline people rolling up to a VP. It doesn't make any sense. So there would be layers of reporting hierarchy in between. If you're a large enough organization and you do have directors, I would expect that people are sort of specialists in sub-functions underneath revenue operations at the director level. So you might have a director of sales ops, a director of marketing ops, director of CS ops or insights or technology, whatever, but you would have sort of sub-functions still underneath the VP that were more focused.
Yeah. And then I would say the other thing that I'd seen is that, and this is definitely not black and white, but it felt like if I try to bucket all the directors we talked to and all the VPs we talked to, on average, not true for everyone, there was a noticeable difference in the presentation skills and just the gravitas that individuals brought to the table. Mm. And the filter that I use for that is like, how do I feel this person would sit down in front of an entire executive team and present?
Mm. I mean, presentation skills are huge. And there's a lot of ways that you can tactically get better at that stuff. I mean, the Toastmasters thing, maybe virtual now, I have no idea, but that, I mean, simple things like getting some experience, actually getting in front of people and speaking is really big. I mean, in the Zoom world, I don't know if there's an equivalent kind of a thing there, but if not, there should be. I would assume that there is. And then just getting your communication style tight and understanding who you're talking to have a seat at that table at the very top end. If you're talking about presentation skills, you should be able to deliver a presentation to a C-suite executive that's short, concise, gets the job done, and you can move on from. You should also be able to present to your team, talk about a roadmap. Here's the next 6 months. Here's the 25 slides of all the different things that we're going to be doing. So having the highly content-rich and explanatory presentation skill and having the brief summarized presentation skill in your back pocket is an absolute must at a pretty polished way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of another example of an individual, and they're a director reporting to a VP, not a VP of revenue operations, a VP of sales, revenue, CRO, what have you. And it felt like that was the filter that would then go through mm-hmm. to the executive team, where this individual is like, okay, this person knows what they're doing. They know what they're saying. They can back up their data, but I, as the VP, need to take it and massage it before we can put this in front of the executive team. And mm-hmm. that to me stood out as a key difference between some of the directors we talked to and some of the VPs we talked to.
I completely buy that. I completely understand that. Part of it is you once you're in the room enough times, and I think you probably picked up on a little bit of this, once you're in the room enough times, you kind of get and can see what other people are doing. I don't know if it's that easy to get the experience ahead of actually getting that occasional seat at the table and having to present to executive leadership about how exactly to present yourself. I think it goes back to skill and preparation, right? You can develop skills that make you a better presenter. You can record yourself and listen to yourself giving presentations and then critique yourself and try to do better next time and get yourself polished in that way. You can also, and with any presentation at any level, the more you prepare and the more you know the content, the better you're going to come across. The less filler words you're going to have, the better you'll be able to answer questions, et cetera. So, I mean, I don't want to say that the difference between a VP and a director is simply that they're more prepared and have more experience, but maybe that is part of the story that you're picking up on.
I think it's definitely part of it. I mean, you can do all this study and preparation you want, but there's nothing that replaces practice. I mean, let's take this thing right here, what we're doing, presenting in front of a live audience. You know, I've got 20 years of experience doing presentations, but the first one we did was super nerve-wracking. Now we're on number 16. It's a lot more comfortable. You know, you just keep doing things again and again and again. And somebody made a comment here and I want to touch on it. But by the way, guys, everybody's throwing comments in, which is great. Very welcome. But let me know if this is actually a question and you want to jump on camera and talk through it. You're welcome to do that. If not, I'll just touch on this. Somebody said, make sure that you have a leader that is willing to, you know, help you grow. And that's so important. Like, the unfortunate reality is some people are going to be in a role where they don't have the right support from their leadership, and they're not going to be given the opportunity to try these things and get feedback. Like, you want to get great at doing a presentation, go do a presentation, align with your manager and ask them to provide you feedback on how you can make it better, and then do it again and again and again and again and again. And then 10 years later, you're going to be really, really good at it. It's funny. I was watching an interview with Marques Brownlee, who's one of the biggest YouTubers. And they're like, how did you get good at this? And he's like, well, if you do anything for 10 years, you're going to get good at it.
The absolute truth in that. Yes. The 10,000 hour thing, maybe a little overkill in presentations. I couldn't do 10,000 hours worth of presentations. I'd have to jump off a bridge, but, no, the practice makes perfect for sure.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, the last thing I wanted to touch on is politics. So you come in and you're a VP of RevOps. Some of the organizations you've worked at, Joel, like, there were a lot of moving parts. Mm-hmm. How did you navigate the politics?
I think the fortunate component of this discussion is that politics, you'll have, hopefully you don't develop any enemies, but you'll have detractors and people that have your back, as long as you're doing a relatively decent job in any role. But if you do a really great job, then you can avoid the politics to a large degree. So I think that's probably the most important thing is, above all else, do good work, deliver value, be well-prepared. Come to work, show up early, leave late, like put in an honest day's work and do all these other things. And then no one will have a beef. The politics around, like, trying to get, let's say, your idea implemented are a little bit more multifaceted. So if you recognize an issue in the business, you know, in revenue operations, you're oftentimes calling a function out for underperformance. And so you have to be careful about how you message that and who's going to actually be the voice for that piece of information being shared to other people. So, for example, I was in maybe a test group for an AI-driven, actually a pre-ChatGPT type of tool that was going to basically look at your CRM data and write written newspaper article reports about what's going on in the business based on that data. And it was going to publish a newsletter to the company. And it looked really, really promising. It was a very cool tool. But, you know, I got around and I was with a bunch of heads of sales, and I was, I think, the only RevOps person in the room at the time. Maybe there was one other person. And the feedback that I gave, and it kind of, like, everybody went quiet for a second and kind of just thought about it and then jumped in and said, yeah, was, I don't think this product will ever sell. And my reasoning is that naked data presented broadly is really dangerous. And the people that are in executive level leadership need to be able and will demand to be able to craft the narrative soften the sharp corners on any piece of information, play up the positives, and try to keep people marching in the same direction. And it's really important that they do that. That isn't like CYA or covering your tracks. It's like, it's the job of a leader to make sure that everybody's got their head pointed forward and everybody is feeling upbeat and has pretty solid morale. So that's always been my thing, is like, you need to make sure that you know who this is going to affect. It's really important to make sure that as a leader, you're creating a narrative that is positive and is not going to get not going to be very negative. You're not pointing and calling somebody out because they're a horrible person. It's just simply, this isn't maybe going as well as it could. Maybe here are some things that we could do better. And by kind of keeping that frame on things, I've been largely able to avoid the politics or get more buy-in than I think, let's say, the alternative option of communicating with people.
Yeah. I mean, I think let's talk about a specific example. You know, unfortunately today, like, we still see this conflict between sales and marketing, this mm-hmm. misalignment where some people in marketing, less and less so every day, are really measured on marketing qualified leads, and then sales obviously being measured on closed deals, and that misalignment that comes into play.
Yep.
And then you may say, well, you know, there's a better way. Let's track everything towards revenue. And there may be a person in marketing that's saying, hey, like, this now threatens me. How do you navigate something like that? And that's, I think, what I meant when I'm talking about politics, where you're thinking, okay, here's a better way for us to run a revenue operation, but I have to be sensitive to all the stakeholders that are going to be at play here, because I may have a chief marketing officer that's extremely influential in the company. And if I'm not thinking about that, that might be detrimental.
Yeah. And I would actually take a step back and take a look at the broader organization and recognize that where we are in the development of revenue operations is not where it will be. And what I mean by that is, you oftentimes will be reporting to the head of sales. They may have a CRO title, but there may be a separate chief marketing officer. There may be a separate CS leader. And so what I think will happen in the future is CRO is going to literally mean chief revenue officer. It's going to have all those different things underneath it at most SaaS companies. But today, it's very hodgepodge. I have actually rolled up to as many CFOs as I have CROs. And the reason is because you need to be a truth teller. And you need to be able to call things out that are true and not have it spun to serve one party versus another. So the classic fight between marketing and sales, well, it doesn't work great if you roll up to sales, right? Because then you'll be maybe seen, rightly or wrongly, as biased in that direction. Okay, so recognize, first of all, where you sit and maybe what all of this stuff will come across if there is a contentious point to be made between, let's say, marketing and sales. So start there. If you don't roll up, if let's say you do have the ideal state and there's a CRO that has marketing and sales and CS and maybe a couple other things underneath them, and you are a neutral observer, so to speak, then trying to... I would hope that if you've been around for a while, that you wouldn't be in a position where the marketing team was organized around a single metric that is different than what the sales team is organized around. That's actually right. The ideal of revenue operations is that we don't have that kind of thing, that misalignment. Now that does exist in a lot of places. So how do you play with that one? I would say early days, try to convince the leader of that whole organization that revenue is what matters. And here are some things that lead to revenue, and lead gen and MQLs, for example, may be, or are certainly a part of that story, but that it's not that, let's say, MQLs are key on their own. It's that they link to this, which converts at this rate, which leads to this, which leads to bookings, which leads to revenue. And so sort of walking every metric back from either revenue or from bookings, and include renewals in that, by the way, like, and how sort of step function happens through the funnel, through the sales cycle, through the retention lifecycle, and linking all those things together. And from that point forward, everything becomes neutral. And I think that's probably mapping that all out is a big undertaking, but it'll help avoid the conflict between marketing and sales, because you wouldn't go to that conversation saying MQLs are awesome, but sales isn't selling. This is a classic example of the fight between marketing and sales. What you would say is MQLs are maybe not converting the way that we anticipated or the way that we thought into sales. What are some things that we can do to adjust that? And so you have both a little bit of, well, what can marketing do better, maybe to qualify or improve the quality of those leads? But then what can sales do to maybe act upon a lead when it comes in more quickly? Or, you know, what kind of customer conversations are we having with that group of people? It becomes more of a team approach to things when you've got this end-to-end thing stitched together, as opposed to just marketing's silo and then sales' silo.
Much easier to do if you're reporting to somebody that has that purview, as opposed to like a departmental leader, like a VP of sales or a CMO that has, you know, their own battle to fight.
Yeah. I mean, regardless of who you roll up to, the remit for revenue operations should be the same. You should be the person who is not, for lack of a better term, glorified sales ops, works for sales and only cares about sales. You should be, in all cases, looking and trying to be end-to-end with everything. And the reporting structure, if you're, you know, doing the job properly, shouldn't matter that much. Just know that if, like, you bring up something that is, if you've done even all that stitching together and you've got your conversions and touch points mapped out from end to end, and you come to the table and say MQLs are underperforming, just understand, one, that may look like it's coming from sales blaming marketing. So start off in some way by, you know, diminishing that concern in your conversation with whoever it is, if the marketing person is in place, and then talking through with that person, maybe ahead of the broader team group where we deliver this information to the executive team or whatever, having to sit down with the marketing person and like saying, hey, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to say our leads are down or our leads are not converting or whatever is bad about leads, and sort of allow them to say, okay, if you're going to go out there with this, okay, show me the data. You show them the data and then say, let's craft the message about what this is, what's causing it, how we're going to do better. And then that way they're prepared when they come to that conversation with the broader team and they're not blindsided by anything. You can never, should never deliver bad news in a broader sort of a setting that blindsides any individual that's in that meeting.
It's great advice. The thing that I would add to that particular example is also, well, and many examples, is drilling layers deeper. So when we take MQLs, it may not be that all MQLs are not converting, but that certain channels are not converting. And maybe that chief marketing officer would appreciate that intel, because maybe they are not seeing it with whatever data set they're looking at. Or maybe, you know, they don't have a login to Salesforce and they're seeing that these opportunities are created, but then they're not closing. And why? You know, is it because we don't have budget? Is it because there's no responsiveness? Is it because the sales rep took it all the way to presentation and then lost the deal? There's a lot of context in there that could be helpful to everybody beyond just MQLs are not closing.
Yeah, and there's a bunch of different examples and the results, and I completely agree with you, Eddie. That is a really, really, really good point. Just because leads, let's say lead flow is down and, you know, absent anything else, we would have called that out and we would have said that's bad in and of itself. That may not be bad. That may be a great thing. Maybe we've gone through the process of really like locking in our personas and now we're being more targeted and we have more personalized messaging. And, you know, that's leads being down. It's just a simple fact of the way that we're doing things that is better than the way that we did them before. We may have a lower conversion rate to sale from leads that are coming in. Leads maybe haven't changed, but they're not closing. That may be a sales problem more than it is the marketing problem. We might be targeting the right people. We might have the amount of people or amount of leads that we want to see, and maybe they're just not being followed up with. So yeah, call out the metrics. Something's happening here, but going the layers deeper, it may point at sales. It may point at marketing. It may point at the systems and tools that you have that aren't alerting the right people to go follow up on the lead. It could be a thousand different things. And it's really not anyone that we know of to blame just based on one metric. There's so many other pieces that tie to everything.
Yeah. Or it may be that like these aren't closing for most sales reps, but there's a few sales reps for which it is closing. And then you want to look at, well, yeah, why is that happening?
Yeah. Ask the why more than once, go deeper, go deeper, go deeper, and then come back up to the surface when you have a really good answer and a hypothesis for making it better. Always come with the solution as well. I know this is not a, a new idea, but come with the solution if you ever bring a problem. And it's way better to just say, hey, this is broken. Thanks, guys.
That's I wish we had more time to dive into that, because coming with a solution, coming with an action plan, saying like, look, this is what I need from you, Mr. or Ms. Leader. This is what we in RevOps can do. Here's how we can solve this problem is so powerful, but we're at time. We don't have time to keep going into this. So
another topic for another day. Yeah,
exactly. Well, we'll be here every week. So Joel, thank you for putting this all together and sharing everything you've learned over the years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Happy to be here. And I hope other people got something out of today's conversation.
Sarah, thanks as always for putting this together for us and producing this as well.
Thank you, everyone.
All right. Cheers, everybody. Have a great week.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody, for joining.